You have to get in contact.
It is Thursday, February 6th, 2020. And this is collective bargaining with the Board of Trustees of the University of West Florida and the University of West Florida Chapter of the United Faculty of Florida. You know, I probably said this also too, but someone, I signed something the other day, you know, like I dated it. Like I've been dating I frequently date. It was like 1/29/20. They see this already? They gave it back to the lawyer. Said, "Now you have to fix that." I said, "Why?" They go, "Like you can't put 20. You have to put 2020." I said, "Well, what?" She goes, "Because anybody can put a number after 20.
Oh, after 20, it to make it.
And then it's like they can put 2019. Somebody can write 19 after that, and then that's our whole
thing."
Yeah,
yeah. I didn't talk about that.
I was like,
Y2K2, right? Yeah, I get it. That's why we sign in blood, just to make sure, you know.
So.
Do you want to say our names? Do we want to go around?
I'm Mike Vanamore.
Kim Woodock.
Justin Davis.
Chastity Hobbs.
John Fink.
Daniel Pace.
Ryan Demian.
Dan Lucas.
Chrisandra Braswell.
We probably both have things, and we have some things today too. Okay. Whatever you would like to do, we're happy to present what we have. If you'd like to hear that first,
would be, why don't we do that?
Because it might.
And then if we need to take a caucus, we'll give you something so that you can look at it during the caucus.
That sounds great. Some of the things we've been thinking about, not only balancing what we've been talking about in bargaining, but also looking at our schedule, thinking about timeline, thinking about what the type of things that are in the best interest of the university, right, and faculty. And so what we're hoping to try to do is to kind of reorient our attention a little bit in bargaining to help move forward in a pragmatic way, right? We did a good job of signing off on a lot of article status quo initially. I think that we've had a lot of good kind of aspirational discussions, you know, talking about our concerns of different issues, right? What we'd hopefully like to do is to try and focus in more on places where there's consensus, right, or potential compromise, the art of the possible, as they say.
So that
has a couple of characteristics, right? One item is I think we'll next meeting on the 18th. One of the things we would like to do is to bring in a second round of going through the CBA and see if there's additional articles that following our conversations would be willing to do status quo.
Good.
Right? And so I think the scope of our conversation has mostly been about grievance and some other of the things that we've discussed. I think some of maybe the ones that we left open initially, we might be able to go back through those and to identify articles. So if that's okay with you guys, we'll prepare a list and hope you guys will maybe prepare some of those as well.
Okay, we'll do the same.
The second issue is, so we've also tried to go back over some of the materials we've been discussing and listening closely to on the university about your interest and our interest, and look for where there are places where there's potential compromise, right, that could be met. So we have two proposals today, and these are proposals that are proposed as a team in partnership, okay, right? They reflect some of your guys' interests and some of our interests, and that they're intended to be shared. So the first is Article 6. Yeah. What's that? Is there Morse coming?
Oh, you have that?
Do you need one here?
Probably
like, who knows, kids, okay. Cookie crumble.
I'm hoarding them over
here. Yeah.
I'm hoarding sixes.
There's a six there. And then the second one is Article 9. In, you know, we had initially proposed Article 6 as status quo. You all had brought some issues to the table that you felt like should be addressed, that you wanted to address. A couple of those issues, right? One issue was what we heard you saying is that you wanted to make sure that Article 6 clearly referenced our obligations towards Title IX. Right? And as we've said, we recognize that you know, as an institution that receives federal funding, we have an obligation to abide by Title IX. One of the, as we said at the table, though, we believe that it's structurally best to reference those obligations to Title IX rather than to reiterate the content of Title IX or other laws in general into the CBA, right? So the first issue, what we've done, and this is language is taken, I think, from the FSU CBA where they do this. So we've specifically said that this is unlawful discrimination and unlawful harassment, including Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, the Violence Against Women Act, and the Jean Cleary, disclosure of campus security policy and campus crime statistics acts. And then we say the parties affirm their commitment to create, et cetera, right? So we're referencing those specifically. If I don't know, you all would know more than I, but if there are additional laws that we would may potentially want to reference in that are current, that would be fine as well for us to review those and look at those. The second issue that you all brought to our attention on Article 6 had to do with the consensual relationship language and the understanding of that obligation to report. What I understood you all to say was that our current language, which defines a conflict of interest in a consensual relationship, is when a faculty member. You okay, Mike?
Sounded like someone was popping popcorn or something behind me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's one kitchen.
Yeah, it's a kitchen.
There is it. Yeah. It's like, okay. We also have brought to your attention some popcorn.
Yeah, somebody's hungry.
Maybe this will change your mind.
Yeah.
You have to sign first.
Like, no,
I've heard it.
No. Yeah. My children are in there. Just ignore them behind that curtain.
That's a cheap bribery.
So what you all brought to our attention was that you felt that the current language about consensual relationships was too narrow in its reporting obligation. Right now, it says that if an employee is in a relationship with someone who is, they are grading, right? They have to be explicitly in that person's class. That in order to for that conflict of interest to be reported and to need to be resolved, that you all felt that was too narrow. You felt that there were instances where someone could directly influence someone else in a relationship that were not being captured by that current language. We had conversations about that. You know, there's pros and cons about a more inclusive language, right? That you lose that bright line, but you also capture more opportunities. But we're welcome. We're willing to accept that concern that you all put forward. We simply proposed that a conflict of interest arises when individuals with the authority to directly influence or evaluate the work or performance of an employee, student, or student-employee initiate, acquiesce, or engage in an intimate romantic and or sexual relationship with that employee, student, or student-employee. So the only thing we've changed is instead of just the responsibility to evaluate, we've made it a more inclusive to directly influence or evaluate.
All right.
Now, that's going to create a broader reporting obligation, some uncertainty that will need communication, what constitutes directly influence. But we're willing to move in that direction in connection to our other proposals.
Good.
As well. Okay.
Okay.
In Article 9, there were both of our teams brought some concerns to this article, some different issues. Some of the things that you all, or specifically, they seem more focused on just clarification of just some language issues, some just structural things. Things like at the bottom of page 1, the fixed term multi-year appointment, right? Adding that language in at the bottom of 9.3a. This is in the about contracts. So we've captured that language. We have also captured Let's see. And at the top of the third page, you said that this is in the transitioning from a 12-month to a 9-month contract. The language is a little bit different, but you all had identified that you wanted to make sure that any temporary supplement was not included in that calculation of base salary when you transition back. Right, so we have that language. For the purpose of determining base salary for this adjustment, any temporary supplement shall not be included in the calculation of base salary. Right, it's the spirit of what you guys have identified. Now, this is the language that we've proposed for clarification in summer appointments. Right, and you all did also propose some language which we've incorporated as well. But what we've proposed here is that the current language says that the criteria for supplemental summer appointments will be made available in each department or unit. Right, we're proposing to provide clarity to that it's specifically in the departmental bylaws, and that these are minimum standards that they will subscribe by. Right, departmental unit written criteria for supplemental summer appointments shall subscribe at a minimum to the following criteria, right? And those criteria are: appropriately qualified in-unit faculty shall receive priority for supplemental summer appointments. Any course rotation or allocation structure implemented as part of a department or unit written criteria for supplemental summer appointments shall demonstrate equitable opportunity among appropriately qualified departmental or unit in-unit faculty to receive a supplemental summer appointment. And third, the amount of salary an in-unit faculty member receives for a supplemental summer appointment shall not be a consideration in the prioritization or allocation of supplemental summer appointments, right? So we want to give departments, units, the ability to continue to define their supplemental summer appointment criteria in connection to this waiver, but we want to make sure that they subscribe to these elements as a minimum. You all had proposed language stating that no employee shall be obligated to accept a supplemental summer appointment, and you wanted a timeline on how soon they have to accept a supplemental summer appointment. So we've also included: an employee shall accept and offer a supplemental offer of a summer appointment within 12 calendar days of the receipt of the formal written offer, or forfeit his or her preference. Now I think you all said it's like maybe 6 days. We've made it a little bit longer, so there's 12 days on that. And we've also said this mirrors language that's in the job. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mike. It's in the job abandonment article, right? We have language that's similar to this. It says: should extenuating circumstance reasonably prohibit the faculty member's consideration of or response to the offer, this timeline shall be extended to allow the faculty member 12 additional calendar days to consider and respond to the offer. So it's the spirit of that language that's in job abandonment, that like if they're gone for a certain amount of time, you know, it's reasonable that would be extended.
Okay.
And then the only other thing that we have, I think, in here is we've just struck this raise from several times ago, just language needs to be struck at the end. A couple of quick things real quickly before we just to give you a sense of those supplemental summer guidelines, the university has a page that maintains all the bylaws for all the departments. They're relatively up to date. I don't know how up to date all of them are on there. It currently lists 34 departments in the university. There's 30 sets of bylaws that are on there that we've reviewed. We've written the four departments or so that aren't listed on there, and we've gotten bylaws from three of them. So we've been able to get bylaws from everybody except for one department. Of those 33 departments, 26 already have the supplemental summer guidelines in their departments, right? So we're looking at about an 80% ratio. And those have been going on for past practice for a long time. Like, right, what was it, been 20 years that you guys have had that?
At least 20 years.
Yeah, at least 20 years they've had that
years or more,
rotation in their bylaws.
We have a point system, it keeps on going.
Yeah, so these are clearly established past practice that's been going on. You know, what we want to make sure to do is to codify that in the CBA, and to also get those five or six outliers, you know, to make sure that they're including those in their bylaws as well. Additionally, none of the criteria that are in those bylaws would be in conflict with the language that we've proposed, right? There's nothing, it wouldn't require any of those departments. In some, it might provide more guidance than they've included, right? But there's nothing in our reading that would be in conflict with any of the current guidelines that are in those department bylaws. So our primary focus in that, and it also is to help, you know, limit the potential for grievances and other things. The more that this is codified in these bylaws, the less that we would potentially have to pursue those items, departments that haven't, included those or updated those or are following them. Okay.
Okay, good.
And that's really it. So right now, that's our perspective, to kind of look at these things in tandem. We're dependent upon each other, and to try and identify additional ones where we might do status quo.
Good. Does anybody have any questions about 6 or 9 as presented? Tim? Daniel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we're going to go across the hall and discuss it. Before we do that, we have taken a stab at another Article 22.
Okay.
And I think it does away with the arbitration panel, correct? We're backed off of that.
Okay. So, and that's just kind of our status quo arbitration as it
is? It's kind of how arbitration would currently work. The parties would go through the process of selecting an arbitrator or a panel of arbitrators. I don't know which. Do we have a permanent panel that rotates, or do you select off a list? Because now I think we have a permanent panel.
I think that's what RCB is.
I don't know that it exists. Although I think there is language added throughout with the intent to clarify things, but I don't think there's some major changes. There is a pretty significantly new section on mediation.
Okay.
But
which is new today, but it's not status quo.
It was in the previous.
Yes.
Okay.
Mediation.
I think it was slight tweaking after the discussion, but it's not like today you're seeing mediation for the first time.
Yeah, sure. We've said we're interested in the possibility of mediation.
Yeah.
Do you want to just? I've found that when we've been looking at big changes, like holistic changes, that the process that, from my experience in this years we've been doing this, has been to kind of work outside in, right, to kind of get an agreement in spirit on it, and then move towards working on language, right. So, do you want to talk just a little bit about like what the spirit of this is, or what the large structural changes are that you're envisioning here?
Besides the fact that we thought the mediation would be helpful. And be helpful early on in the process rather than how it usually occurs, which is very late in the process. Is there anything, Crescendo, that you think is a major lift in here? I think it's mostly clarification. I think we're trying to capture what exists, right?
Some of the filings are trying to clarify, I guess, and add in where we can use email now. I think we noticed that last time. But I don't think there's anything.
I'll ask it this way. So right now we have step one, step two, and then arbitration, right? You're proposing an introduction of mediation into that. Is that mediation replacing either of those steps? Is it a required mediation that precedes step one? Is that what you're proposing?
No. The mediation is proposed in this article as a condition precedent, so it's required prior to going for the arbitration hearing. So once a faculty member of the union files their request for arbitration, at that point in time, the mediation will get set up. And hopefully, if at that point in time it can be resolved, that's good.
Okay.
If it can't, the mediator would just simply give notice to the president's office that an impasse was reached and nothing else to maintain confidentiality of the mediation process, and then the arbitration hearing would get set.
It would still be step one and the step one and step two unchanged as it currently is, right? So it would go step one, step two, mediation, then arbitration.
Correct. Right.
Okay. Are there timelines connected to the mediation about like is it an unending mediation, or if the mediation, the teams aren't able to reach mediation within so much time?
Not in this proposed draft. There's not a
okay
dead, yeah, you have Okay. I think you have to within
30 days. So you have 30 days to agree upon the mediator.
Yeah, and then 30 days after that, I think it's when you can go to arbitration hearing, but how long it takes in there about...
Okay.
I don't think mediation is normally... You could go on forever, but I think you would have like a day, maybe two in my mind.
Sure.
The mediator would hear the issues. But if that's something that you all wanted to look at moving forward and propose something, but as it is right now, there isn't any strict timeline.
Were you envisioning, because we had talked to the table about potentially using federal mediators, is this a federal mediator system that you're looking at, or who did you envision as the mediators?
So in B on page 8, so upon receipt of notice of intent to proceed to arbitration, the UFF, UWF, and UWF will mutually agree upon a mediator within 30 days, and then we've added in after the discussion that should the parties choose, a federal mediation and conciliation services mediator may serve as the mediator.
Okay. Okay.
So that option is available.
Okay. Well, it's a lot to look at. We appreciate your thoughts on this. And as we said, you know, that possibilities of mediation are things that we're supporting and looking at.
It looks to me like we sort of clarify what is our position, which is that an act of academic discretion is not subject to being substituted for by an arbitrator's decision. But that, I mean, that doesn't mean that the process of tenure, promotion, or evaluation, or non-reappointment is not subject to the grievance and arbitration process, but it would be subject to the grievance and arbitration process because of a procedural defect and not because the arbitrator is being asked to consider independently, de novo, an application for tenure, for example.
What language are you referring to? Are you saying that you're excluding things from arbitration that are grievances? And the potential of arbitration?
We're saying that they're excluded now. We're just making it. There is some language in here that reiterates it.
So I think it's whether or not someone in the administration made a decision to grant tenure to someone and that person didn't get it. That they can't just say, you know, I was expecting tenure, I wanted it, I don't like their decision, I'm grieving.
Right.
It's more like if there was an issue in the process getting to that point within the CBA, of course, they can grieve that. And that's still the case, but I think it's just clarifying that that's also the case with, because I think it says not limited to or something, but with like a non-reappointment or an evaluation. Like if there's an issue with the process getting there, then of course you can grieve that like you can now. But it's just clarifying.
So it's always been in the contract, and it's under authority of the arbitrator, it used to say where an administrator has made a judgment involving the exercise of discretion, such as decisions regarding, these are just examples, such as tenure or promotion, the arbitrator will not substitute the arbitrator's judgment for that of the administrator, nor will the arbitrator review such a decision except for the purpose of determining whether the decision has violated this agreement. So we're still committed to that language.
Mm-hmm.
Then it has a process of what an arbitrator can do if it is faced with the possibility that a decision is violated.
Well,
a decision is made not to promote someone based on the merits of their application, and an arbitrator would say, I'm going to look at the arbitration, I'm going to look at the promotion application and review it and say, I don't agree, I think this person is great and should be promoted.
Well, you know, we've we've certainly discussed in the past. This is an issue that's come up in the past, right? Yeah. It's not the first time. And we've discussed what's stated in the Florida statutes already, right? That a arbitrator shall not substitute his or her judgment for that of the. I'm just kind of paraphrasing, right? But that's already stated directly in the Florida statutes. But we'll look at closely at the language that you've been proposed here as well, because simultaneously, we have outcomes from a sequence of arbitrations that have just taken place at UWF, where those arbitrators have explicitly said that an evaluator's has to be truthful, right? It cannot be invented, right? And they have ruled that it can't be arbitrary or capricious, right? Now that's not substituting the position of the arbitrator for the, but it's evaluating that these are demonstrably untruthful based on the circumstance that was presented in those hearings. So. We'll look at your language.
And I'm familiar with those decisions. I was involved in those decisions. Although I do know that one of the arbitrations, as we all know, one of the arbitrations resulted in the university going to the circuit court and having it reversed because the arbitrator stepped too far in determining what the evaluation should be instead of just saying, this evaluation is defective, go do it again.
And that's a good example, because that my understanding is that the circuit court did not throw out the arbitrator's decision, but said that the arbitrator had overstepped those bounds and pulled it back to those bounds, basically saying that the narrow window in which the arbitrator had overstepped his bounds was specifically related to requiring someone else to do a evaluation, right? And so they said, no, the person is entitled to do their evaluation, right? You can't designate someone else. But they did not vacate the arbitrator's decision or say that it has no right to say
well,
that.
Well, otherwise the arbitrator, whether we agree with him or not, otherwise the arbitrator found that there was a procedural defect in that the wrong criteria was applied. So, and we understand that. But then he sort of dictated how the process would carry itself out going forward, and we had a problem with that in the court did too.
Okay.
And so just to the proposed changes would in essence change the arbitrations that have gone forward. It's just because the arbitrators found procedural issues. And so somebody could still agree that there was a procedural issue, and it's just whether or not you're looking at the decision that was made. I just wanted to, so from the prior Article 22 that was proposed, two things that have been shaved off here in an effort to come to agreement. And that one, all grievances were going to go to step one, were they from the union or from faculty, and here we've shifted back to how it is now, where it's a union. It can come in at step two. If it's an individual, it starts at step one. And then we've also dropped the arbitration panel.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned, I think, I don't have tons to do with the grievance, but I think we do have, a list of approved arbitrators. I remember a few years ago, wasn't that list produced, right? I think it was their exact question. Don't we have a list of arbitrators somewhere?
I think there's a list of arbitrators stored in an empty mayonnaise jar
guarded by an alligator. It's guarded by an alligator.
Was dropped in the middle of the water feature out front, and we're going to do a search for a scuba search at some point.
It's with SpongeBob SquarePants.
It could be. Listen, I think SpongeBob is on the actual arbitration list.
Yeah.
Just follow the circle of the Nautilus shell as it gets farther and farther.
Yeah,
okay, we'll review. Thank you guys for your thoughts on this. I hear the teams on the same page of focusing and narrowing.
I think for the major pieces of change that we suggested before, we're trying to get back to more of a status quo grievance arbitration.
Oh, by the way, I noticed one real quickly now. Hang on just a second. Sorry. On 22.9, right? I see I'm on to all of your wily tricks. You've said verify electronic mail to faculty reconvey at UWF rather than faculty grievance. This is the wily tricks that you guys are doing. See here on 22.9. The email address is faculty reconvey. This is on page 13. You say, aha, you filed it to faculty grievance, not faculty reconvey. It was never received, right? So we're on to your wily tricks.
Okay.
Wow.
And, all right. Well,
is that French?
We have to give that up.
We caught you.
Just the V and the C were swapped.
It's like confefe.
Oh, no, this is French.
Yeah.
Faculty confefe. It
means grievance.
The response will be in French.
Yeah.
Yes. On the bad account.
All right. We'll. Did you guys have a conference room or a place?
Yeah, we have a place to go.
Okay. We'll probably need